Hello, this is Sean.
And Justin.
And we're back in 2009 for the Dot Matrix.
2009, yeah! No?
Justin's just been popping some pills.
Robaxacet, yeah!
Is that what you had?
Yeah.
Wow.
I got my back, man. I don't know what it is. Man, I don't know why I'm saying man, but anyways.
Yeah, you'll have to join me on some yoga. I know some good back stretches that might help.
Good.
And then you can kind of wean yourself off the pill dependency.
Right, that's true. Might be a good idea.
Or you could just keep going on the drugs.
Yeah, I mean, that also works fine for me.
Oh my.
So we're episode 21, the first one of 2009. And first and foremost, we're a new year, a new set of podcasts, and a new microphone. Tell us about this mic, Sean.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I keep wanting to go in, but I don't have to do that. I don't have to get too close to the mic.
It's interesting that, like, I think we're talking rather normally, but the levels are still fairly, like, we see the levels go quite erratic when we do it before, but now it seems quite normal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think it's leveled out the overall track better.
Right.
So, like, if we get too loud, it won't distort as much, so...
I keep thinking I need to talk louder because I'm not making enough dent on this thing, you know?
I know.
It's kind of scaring me.
Well, the great thing, too, is that... sorry, this gets a little technical, but when we... You know, the post-podcast part that I do?
Yes, geek, yeah. sorry. That wasn't even clever.
Like, it was okay. Yeah.
Oh,
I got a little giggle out.
You're too kind. Keep going though.
But in GarageBand, you can actually level out the volume, and you can do a bunch of different editing stuff, kind of basic editing. And
right.
And I think hopefully this mic will help us kind of even out everything and just have a little more balanced sound. But I don't know. Maybe we'll get some feedback from listeners after. But hopefully,
well, it looks like a giant softball. It looks like a softball on a camera pod is what it looks like.
It's called the Snowball.
I was going to say snowball, but then I changed it to softball because I figured people wouldn't know. It depends how big people make their old snowballs.
Yeah. It's a really large snowball. It's got its own little stand. It's really nice. And
so where'd you get it?
I got it at the Apple Store.
The Apple Store? The one in downtown? Yeah. Well, there's only one
downtown here, Vancouver.
Downtown Vancouver.
And it's funny you ask because, you know, we had been talking about, you know, looking into different microphones because so far we've been just using the built-in microphone on the Mac, on the iMac, which has been working reasonably well.
Yep.
And, you know, who knows? We might not even notice too much of a difference, but I think it captures their voices better, and hopefully won't be so lost when we're talking at different levels. And I went in there, and Elaine found it, and there was this and a snowflake. And the snowball was bigger, and it was really recommended for podcasting.
Right.
And I looked at different companies, and I was like, This one, you could really, it gave a good description of how it worked, and we checked some reviews online while we were there, and they seemed pretty positive. So I went for it, and it wasn't too expensive. So
good.
It's good.
The company is Blue. Is that the
it's
company?
Blue?
Blue. Okay. B L U E. For those of you looking for it on online.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll put a link on our site to it.
We definitely can. And the great thing about it is that, you know, it's good for people like me that I don't have all the crazy interfaces and, you know, all the different jacks and stuff. It's a USB mic, and they've really come a long way with USB mics. You just plug and play, and it's very easy. It recognizes that you've plugged in a new microphone and asks you if you want to use it, and you do, and you say yep, and then you start recording. So we'll see how this works, but I think it's going to be hopefully a good investment.
Nice, yeah. I think it's cool.
Yeah.
I think it looks pretty neat. It looks kind of retro. It looks kind of like a grill to a 1950s car of some, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
you're
gonna go to the soda shop, and some girl with roller skates and a poodle skirt's gonna come and ask for your burger order, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why, but it does.
Well, it looks like those retro restaurants, like that kind of 50s retro kind of style. It's got its own little stand, so it's perfect. Like, because otherwise, I would have to go find a stand somewhere. But this works for us, so.
Neat.
Yes.
Cool. So it's 2009, and we both of us have absolutely nothing written on our pieces of paper in terms of what we want to talk about, unless you've written something down. You have written something down.
I did after we got together here, just about, we had touched base last year about the fact that we were going to come back have a podcast before the Canadian Parliament resumes on the
26th, I think it is.
So yeah, last week of January anyway. Right. And then we were going to do one after that just to, so I thought maybe we could maybe think about some predictions of what we think might happen.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah?
Sure.
Okay, why don't you start?
Damn.
Oh, or I can start.
Well, see, it's very interesting because I don't know what's happened. The last time we podcast, we talked about the coalition and what mm-hmm. our views of the coalition were.
Right.
And had Dion already stepped down and Michael, so that had already happened.
Oh, no. Dion had just stepped down that day and we didn't know who was going to be leader yet.
Right, okay. And and obviously Michael Ignatieff, scholar extraordinaire, liberal MP somewhere in Toronto, I think one of the ridings in Toronto,
right.
has ascended to the Liberal leadership rather quickly, and it, you know, couldn't be a smoother transition for that guy, right? So he's now the new leader. The coalition, for all intents and purposes, seems dead. Like, I don't think it doesn't seem to have much steam to it anymore. And my prediction just is, I mean, and when they're talking about budget consultation, because the budget's going to come out on the 26th or the 27th or whatever, or I think the budget comes on the 26th and then they vote on it on the 27th.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
So that's when the vote is, and they're, and all of the Liberal, like Ignatieff and others in the Liberals, I haven't heard anything from Kitchen Table Leighton at all about anything. He hasn't said much, at least not that I can think of.
Yeah.
But Ignatieff have been very much like, well, we'll see what's in the budget, and saying every sentence that you could say to position yourself in a way to basically pass it.
Yeah.
Right. And that's my prediction. And I don't know if you think any differently, but it seems kind of like a no-brainer now that, you know, in the end, Stephen Harper did win in whatever this strategy game is, because he kind of did a little bit of muscling. It kind of backfired, I guess, a little bit, but he still got Parliament prorogued or suspended. He's kind of having a little bit of a rise in the polls right now, although most likely that's not going to last. I mean, it's just, you know, temporary, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he'll come back, and they'll do this budget. It will probably pass, and he'll be Prime Minister still. I mean, that's my gut.
You know what? I've been kind of tossing back and forth between that and an election.
Really? So you think...
Well, I thought more before Ignatieff was confirmed leader. I thought more on the side of an election.
Right.
But you're right. Since he became leader, I think what's going to happen is the Conservatives are barely going to put forward something agreeable to the other, agreeable enough to the other opposition parties where they might vote on it to pass it, in the sense that they're not going to be so extreme, they're not going to be so ideological, they're going to remove all that kind of extreme stuff and actually maybe have something in there that will address the economy woes. But you're right, I think if it doesn't, there won't be a coalition in its place, because Ignatieff has been very chilly towards coalition. He was like the last to sign on to that.
Right.
And I've seen interviews on the national news networks where he says, unless they put forward something that they can go with, there is still the coalition idea on the table, but you can tell they're going to just use it as last resort. And I think now, even since then, even in the last couple of weeks, I think Ignatieff is like, you know what? If we don't pass this thing, we're going to just see what the Governor General wants to do. Either she won't prorogue it again, but she'll call an election. And
so you think that's a real possibility that she would call an election? Like,
as opposed to putting the coalition in?
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah?
Because I don't think Ignatieff wants to do a coalition. I think he'd rather go as the leader of the Liberals now that he's leader.
Right.
I don't know how likely any of this is, really. I think you're right. I think overall, I'm actually leaning more, as I talk it out, towards your point.
Right.
Which is, I think somehow conservatives will come up with something that it would be silly for the others, it would look really petty for the others to turn it down.
Right.
And yeah. That's what I think might happen. I think he'll still remain prime minister, but I'll just say this quickly. I think if another year or two passes without an election, by the time we do have an election, it will be a much closer race with Ignatieff as the leader.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
I think liberals will finally start to get their act together and what they want to do.
Right.
And have a clearer message, and they'll be a way stronger contender towards Harper.
Right.
That's my thought.
Huh.
But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. It seems so much intrigue, and now it's more as this prorogament. I really didn't want the parliament to prorogue or be suspended, because I knew that once you take the wind out of the sails, like that moment for that coalition was then, at that moment. And I think now that everything's suspended to the end of January, like, everything got deflated, right? I mean, Dion gone, Ignatieff in, everyone's downplaying the whole coalition. Like, whether or not you're for or against it, like, it seemed like the coalition's time was going to be then. And it would only work if the Governor General decided not to prorogue. But she did. I think that... in itself was the turning point. Then it's pretty predictable after that, I think. So
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that it sounded like you were saying you didn't want her to prorogue.
Yeah, I wanted it to fall, the chips fall as it did, really? And see what happened.
See, I don't know, forgive me if I said contrary back in that time, a month ago, I don't remember what I said, but I think...
We can go back.
We'll have to research that. But I'm actually glad she did. You know why?
Do tell.
Because, and I think I said this last time, but I think that coalition was a farce.
Yes.
And I would, even though I don't like the idea of proroguing, suspending our parliament, I think that was the lesser of the two evils than having a leaderless coalition, essentially, effectively.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
No solid leader. They had done all those other parties combined, did awful in the election. So I don't think the state of the country would have been that great. I think Harper was an asshole for for getting us in this mess in the first place.
Yeah.
Because that's what he did. He was too extreme ideological, too right-wing. And it was almost like a bluff. They're like, we're going to take this as far as we can and see what they do. And they lost that gamble. And someone deserves to go down for that. I agree. It's just the timing.
Right.
If they hadn't had an election in October, and it was like even 6 months earlier, I would have been more happy with a bogus coalition trying to rule the country than proroguing. But it was too soon after the election. My take on it.
Well, I find it really interesting because, like, I have a much... I mean, not to say that you don't have confidence in, but I have pretty much the federal government is a gigantic ship, right?
Yes.
And no matter who's in power, who's prime minister, who's the ministers, there's a large bureaucracy of deputy ministers, assistant deputy ministers, executive directors, yeah. And down the line, who run the bureaucracy. And and it's going to go a certain place. And unless you have a tidal wave of change, like the Barack Obama train,
yes.
You're not going to move this ship off course really quickly. And I'm more than willing to take a chance and just see what happens and just do a little bit of shit disturbing, right? And just, you know, for me, again, it has nothing to do with ideology and whether or not I agree or disagree with the coalition or whether it was bogus or not. I mean, I have an opinion on that. We talked about it last time. But for me, it's just about there's such blandness on the Canadian political side, and there's such entitlement from those in power or those wanting to get in power that this little bit of controversy or uncertainty and instability is, I think, refreshing. It puts people on their toes. It makes people think, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't be an asshole about something, some policy that's going to, you know, bankrupt other my enemies or my competition. You know, like it's all this gamesmanship that's just a bunch of shit, basically. And I want people to feel like they got to do a good job because they know there's a risk that I could get either trounced by the opposition or in an election or whatever. But it doesn't happen in elections anymore. These tidal waves of change hasn't happened in a Canadian electorate since Brian Mulroney was booted out via Kim Campbell, right?
Back
when Chrétien came in.
And since Joe Clark before that.
Yeah.
In the late 70s, yeah.
And even when, even when that tidal wave of change happened when Kim Campbell and the Conservatives went from government to two seats, what did we get? We got a bland Liberal government of three terms of Chrétien, right? So it doesn't, like, there's none of that... that dynamism and this coalition, you know, warts and all, provided some dynamicness to the Canadian political scene or Canadian governmental scene.
Yeah.
Which I thought would have been, I would have been more than happy to see what happened, right?
You know what? That's a really good point. And that is a good way of looking at it. I think I'm there with you had the coalition been more solid.
Right.
I think it was, we see this in governments all around the world, like other governments, they do coalitions and sometimes it works, you know, and it gets them through things. But with these guys, kitchen table Layton and I don't know what the hell I'm doing, Dion. Got a lot of heart, Dion, but look at that video. We won't go into that. But anyway, what were you going to say?
But I think I was listening to some of the pundits afterwards, after all this happened. And really the problem is, you can talk everything I just said, but the problem is that it was a coalition of three. And you can't, it's just tainted, like you said. I mean, one of your big arguments against a coalition was that the Bloc was involved in however way they were involved.
Right.
And that's a tough thing. I think it would have been much more valid and a much more interesting possibility if you could have a coalition with two. But you can't. The Liberals don't have enough seats to combine with the NDP to actually make 50% plus one seat or whatever that is, right?
And if they had, it would have been better.
I think there would have been much less debate about it.
Yes, correct.
Right? I think, you know, there was just a lot of uneasiness about a separatist party supporting a coalition government on the federal scene. So I get that. I do get that. I don't have as much uneasiness as others do about it. But if that wasn't there, if that wasn't there, I think it would have been a much easier discussion, and it just probably it still wouldn't have happened. I still think regardless, you would have prorogued it.
Yeah.
For all the other reasons we've been talking about. So
well, I think that's a good point, and that kind of leads us to what else happened over the holidays, which was Senate appointments.
Was it the most Senate appointments ever by a prime minister in one go? 18.
Yeah, it's never.
And how many how many journalists got into the Senate finally? Like, in one go? I couldn't believe it.
Well, I was really shocked to hear that they're actually, they consider themselves conservatives, like right wing.
Mike Duffy, I was like, well, but like Pamela Wallin, really? Conservative?
And, yeah, I don't think it has, for those guys, though, and whoever else, the other names escape me, but I don't think it's about what side of the fence they're on. It's about the cash. The cold, hard cash.
What is it, 100 and something?
150
something,
or
yeah.
Something thousand a year, no term limit.
Yep.
75 days of the year they have to sit, or something like that. I mean, it's winning the lottery. And everyone asked Harper, like, all the year-end interviews, and he's like, well, we tried to put forward Senate reform, and it didn't get anywhere. So if you can't beat him, you got to join him. And as much as you could kind of see that point, I just find it so just dishonest. Like, so dishonorable. Like, Like, what the hell? I'm sorry, but you're giving these you're like, hey, come over and join our team. Here's all this money, and you don't have to do any work really. And I mean, it's a windfall, don't you think?
Well, salary wise, for sure.
Holy crap! Yeah. I mean, look, remember the liberal guy who just was always on vacation in Mexico or something?
Yeah.
I mean, I know what it's like to want to even out the different sides on the Senate.
Right.
But I was kind of shocked at that. I think our prime minister has no interest in actually working for the better of the country. I think he's just all about taking sides and, you know... I don't know. I was really shocked. I don't know if you had even any thoughts on it, but...
Well, yeah, I don't really have too many thoughts. I mean, I wasn't necessarily shocked because it sounded like... I mean, there was just all these empty Senate seats, and he didn't appoint any one of them except for the one in Alberta who happened to be elected through a process, right? So he appointed that senator that was elected, which was made sense because that was his principle, right? The senators need to be elected. And it wasn't surprising in the fact that because he almost lost his job as prime minister, basically the cronies in the party, he being one of them, just said, crap, I may not be in this job for much longer. I better appoint as many of these senators as I can.
Yeah.
And I think he filled in, I think that's all that's available is 18 seats right now. And my understanding that this year, another bunch of seats are going to become available because when you turn 75, you retire from the Senate, right? So I think probably a bunch of people are turning 75.
Is it a lot, huh?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, it's not like a huge amount, but it's definitely...
Like several?
Several, yeah. It's like, I think, 3 to 5 or 6 or something like that. So, and probably they're all liberals, so... So I see the point about why he'd want to just do it, just... You know,
get it in there.
And I mean, but I think he did as good as he could have to try to spin it. Like he said, you know, everyone who agreed to be in the Senate all agree in our goal for Senate reform and would vote for it in that way, right? Which, you know, and even Pamela Wallin was saying that you know, she's the Senate seat in Saskatchewan, and they're putting in legislation or it's under consideration to do Senate elections. And if that bill passes, then she would resign her seat and then run in that election.
Hmm.
Which, well, you know, there's so, at least that. You know, so at least, you know, some of that. But I mean, that's, you know, such a minor thing that it's hard to spin the other 17 seats in that way.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I mean, it really is a lot of waste of money, but it's one of those things where I get less upset about it. Not upset, but I just, it's one of those things where, like, you know.
Yeah, you roll your eyes. I mean? Yeah, yeah, I know, I hear you.
And I think about that, and I think about what's going on in the U.S. Senate, which is just as crazy with, like, you know, the governor of Illinois trying to sell Obama's Senate seat and all that craziness, right? And you know, like, I mean, they're all, I mean, no one's got it figured out, you know what I mean?
No, no one does. And that's really funny, yeah. Senate garbage happening everywhere. But that's all I had on my list. I don't know if you had any other stuff you wanted to bring up before we wrap this one.
I mean, I did want to take a bit of time because we didn't spend too much time. And it's funny because my sister listened to this podcast last week, the one that we posted a few weeks ago, and said, gosh, you know, last year you guys spent a lot of time talking about your favorite albums, your favorite whatever, and this year all you did was mention it very briefly at the very end of the year, that very end of the podcast. So I thought maybe we'd take a little bit of time.
Okay.
And, what do you think about 2008? Are you happy to see it go, or are you...
You know...
You know what I mean? Like... How was it as a year for you?
Well, for me, it was fine. I think, I mean, 2008, I mean, everyone had ups and downs for sure, but I think overall, there's a lot of great things that we did in 2008. I had a lot of fun doing, and, you know, like I didn't have any major issues with 2008. I think... The point you bring up, what your sister was talking about, was that at the end of 2007, we did our best of, and we'll have to do that for the next podcast.
Okay.
We'll talk about our best, the best music, maybe best movies. I think maybe if we do that as an annual thing, we can just devote an episode to it.
Right.
And then, but overall for me, you know, for our bands, we had a lot of good shows. We, you know, Elaine and I went to San Francisco in February.
Yes.
And
yes, you've been quite the travelers.
I know. We're trying to get to that more. Like, we're going to go to Paris in April.
Yes. Nice.
So we're really excited about that. And we just came back from Tofino a few days there, which was absolutely beautiful and got a lot of pictures. And we've never been there before. So that was really exciting. And our dog loved it. We went, camping and in the summer to Alouette and you know, lots of little mini events. We had a lot of great dinners amongst us friends and stuff. And
yes, right. I'm hosting the next one. I have to remember to send an email.
That's right. We will talk about that. Hopefully we'll have done it by the next podcast. But what about you? They say it's a long year for a lot of people, which I can understand. But what did you
feel? I don't know. Like, I think about this year, 2009, and the whole... I think I spent way too much time in 2008, and maybe it's way too much time in general, around this whole self-reflection crap. Although I think it's important. I say it crap, but it's not crap. And
it can be.
It can be overwhelming, and it makes it... I don't know. I have mixed feelings about. I mean, there's obviously some health issues in my family, which was a downer of a year. Mm. Although some great things with my niece just coming into her own and becoming her own person and her own personality. I just spent like 2 days in a row helping babysit her on like Friday and Saturday. Awesome.
It's fine, huh?
She is the best thing ever, and so that's some great ups. And I kept thinking, well, but it was a long year. It was a long year. And so I'm happy to see it go, actually, to be honest.
Start new.
And I'm looking at 2009. And I just thought about it just a little bit today. Just walking when I was waiting for you to come here after work. And I'm just, you know, listening to some music on my iPod, walking around, just thinking, you know, I just have to remember, to enjoy the moments and to have a bit more fun this year, I think, is what I want to do. A little bit, be a little bit less serious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be serious all the time is kind of tiring. So that's, I think, my commitment to myself is just to... And part of that is, again, trying to rediscover the passion stuff. But I don't want to be so specific about it, right? Because, you know, just let it be loose, you know?
Yeah.
And just... Because I don't think I have allowed myself to relax that much, as much as I should, and I'm looking forward to doing some of that this year.
Well, you did have a week in Venice Beach?
Yes, in Los Angeles. That was great.
That's cool. Do more of that.
And, well, I'm going to Quebec City in February
for
the weekend in between meetings in Ottawa and then Toronto. So I'm looking forward to that. That should be fun. But yeah, I'm looking forward to 2009, just to have a bit more fun.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and just to discover more things. As I was thinking about you, and this is not has nothing really to do with 2009, or our thoughts of 2008, but poetry. Thinking about poetry. Not that I want to write poetry, but because I don't think I can do it. I'm too long winded to write poetry. But we've had brief discussions about poetry. But I was listening to the most recent Bill Moyers podcast.
John Lithgow,
and who I respect very greatly as an actor, and I mean, when he won his first Emmy for Third Rock from the Sun, I thought, yeah, absolutely, he deserved it. And after a while, he kept winning, and I'm like, that show got really tired really quickly, right? But you could see how the brilliance of him as an individual actor, and then just he had this whole book. I guess it's a compilation of poetry that has inspired him over the years, and he grew up in a family. I mean, he grew up in a family where they're always reading poetry to each other and stuff. And I'm like, well, that's not my family.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And same. To fall in, like, the way he was falling in love with the words and the meaning of words and the play on words and just the artistry of it. And it made me think about you and how you have a much deeper appreciation of poetry than I do. And I just think about that as part of the overall feeling, I think, of what 2009 should be. Just, you know, just
cool.
be more into and more attuned to the simpler things, or to bringing it down. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much length with things and so much complexity that it isn't sometimes all that complex. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right.
And I just thought I just it was just pretty neat and hearing them talk about that. It was almost the full hour. It was almost him, right? And it was quite.
It was. It was a different style of podcast for Bill Moyers. Really, I like when he does the interviews with people because he actually gets really. He gets a lot of people on there, no matter what they're talking about. Really thought provoking. I mean, that I heard. I haven't heard all of it, but I heard when he was talking about that Shakespeare poem, and I was like, yeah, it's really cool. And I love what he thinks about poetry and. Because I don't know, I find myself really in line with that. I find it's really a lost art form, which is kind of too bad in a mainstream kind of way. I mean, there are obviously a lot of poetry lovers around the world, but it's right. not really, it's not at the forefront of any movement really anymore. Like, right. It might have had been up until maybe middle of last century.
Right.
But, you know, after, I mean, essentially since the heyday of the Beats, I guess. But anyway, it's interesting you mention that because that brings it back to that podcast that Bill Moyers did on the war, the soldiers that got into poetry.
After Yes,
fascinating episode. I want to see that again. We can post links to those.
Yeah, and there's one about recently about music and the healing power of music, and it was a documentary about
on Bill Moyers.
Yeah, Bill Moyers. It was and they actually replayed it twice. It was so they got so much response on it.
Really, and, I don't remember coming across that one.
Yeah, it was quite something. I missed it the first time, and then I caught it the second when I did.
Is it on the site?
It probably is on the site. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll look for all three of those then.
Yeah. So. War. I'm gonna write this down.
while we're writing, we'll keep talking, man.
Yeah.
But no, and that's a good one.
Last thing is, and I just have to say this because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And we're gonna put a link to it. That's all I'm gonna say. We don't really need to talk about it. Cool. But I was reading an article, an op-ed thing around George Bush, for George W. Bush, and on the New York Times. So you know it slants anti-Bush.
Sure.
And. I love the New York Times website. I read it all the time.
That's cool. I quite enjoy it, yeah.
And they were talking about sort of the 52-page PDF that's on the White House website about George W. Bush's accomplishments in the 8 years. Really? And how it reads like a children's book, and there's all these did-you-know facts. And like,
oh, I'd really like to see that.
I will post that link on and that PDF. It is... hilarious. I haven't gone through the whole booklet. It's not even a book. It's a booklet, they call it.
So funny.
Did you call it a flyer?
Do you know that whenever there's an unpopular political leader, when they've come out of office, it's always the ones that didn't accomplish very much positive stuff that they always try to promote the most? Do you know it? Like, when Bill Vanderzam, who was premier of BC back in the late 80s and early 90s, I believe?
Yep.
I remember... being at home, this is 20 years ago or almost, when a little leaflet came in the mail and I showed my mom and I said, look, they're listing all of Vanderzam's accomplishments. I've never seen that for anyone else. Because the ones that do accomplish a lot and do a lot of good things, we don't need to be reminded because we know.
Right.
It's the guys who don't. And my mom said this kind of the same thing. Said something to the same effect. She was basically like, oh, well, they're just trying to point out there was actually stuff that he did do, though you never heard about it because of all the crap that he pulled, you know?
Right.
So there's an example of that.
Well, and then, like, they were talking a little bit in this article, and I hopefully the op-ed piece, people can read it without having to register to the New York Times website. Sometimes older articles you have to register to log in to read. I registered finally like a month ago because I figured like I really should register.
You're all over it.
I'm all over it, right? Yeah. And they're talking about how some of the main themes are one that Bush has through his presidencies kept America safe, and then and then this op-ed goes bracket if his presidency started September 12th, 2001, you know, and I know that things happen where the actions and decisions of a previous administration, the results don't get shown until you know, after that person has left office. So,
that's right.
So not all can be blamed on Bush, right? But you cannot say that you kept America safe if in your, during your tenure as president of the United States, the biggest, the most impactful, you know, terrorist attack on your country happened, right? So I that's really true, because they,
that's a good point.
They do promote the fact that, you know, they've kept America safe in his presidency. I mean, it's a constant theme in his administration, in the sort of legacy piece. But yeah, 9/11 didn't happen when he wasn't president. He was president at the time when that happened, right?
And 9 months worth of intelligence that, you know, let it, I don't want to say let it happen, but had a part in letting it happening.
And and then the other thing was how he's led America to the years of prosperity in the bracket in the city, if his presidency ended in September 2007 and not like the last year of crap that we've had, right?
Right.
And so I thought those were kind of interesting points about, like, you have to remember, like, this is, he's still president, right?
That's right.
And going back to your point about sort of the intelligence piece, and then linking it back to Bill Moyers and John Lithgow, because he's on Broadway, and part of the reason why, I guess, they're talking to Lithgow, not just because of his poetry, his book of compilation of poetry, but he's also on Broadway doing an Arthur Miller play at the moment. And they talk a lot about sort of the message in the play around responsibility. And I mean, the play is 60 years old, and I think it's like All My Sons, I think it's called. I forget. And it's about a father who has a manufacturing plant, and he knows that there's something wrong with the product, and he sells the product anyways, goes into, you know, artillery machinery for the army, it malfunctions and 21 men die, right? And the father basically lets his partner take the blame for it. And years pass, and he's kept his job, and he's kept his factory alive, but, you know, he just shunted off the blame to someone else, and then years later the son finds out about what his father has done, and sort of how does it, where does responsibility start and where does it end? At some point, you know, you could have stopped what happened. And then they showed a little they played a little clip of this play, and it makes you really want to see it. And about how, you know, it's not that easy. Like, I mean, obviously, if you do the right thing, you say, you know, this is not going to work. This machinery, what we're manufacturing is crap, and we better not sell it to the U.S. Army or something, right? But then if you do that, then you lose your factory. You lose your business. It's done. It's over. And you lose everything. So what do you do? I mean, what is the answer? I mean, the answer is clear in hindsight.
Sure.
But at the moment, what is the answer?
Yeah.
And then if the answer is clear in hindsight, how does responsibility take shape? And he makes a sort of reflection, and because it was written shortly after World War One, I think it is. Or two.
Yeah.
And about now, and about sort of talks about the faulty intelligence. At some point, someone had to, there's a decision that someone could have looked at this intelligence and go, you know, this is not good enough. This will not go any higher up than me on this desk here at the CIA, FBI, whatever. We're not going to show it to the president. We're not going to, like, it's just not right. But that someone made, at some point, made a decision. And whether or not it's the president who made the decision to just go with it, or is it somewhere further down, someone has to take blame, and no one's taking blame. I think that's really the problem that I think a lot of people get frustrated on, is that no one's taking blame. And I think we all take blame. We all take responsibility in our lives. And this is bigger than life. This is bigger than one individual. This is like the lives of hundreds of millions of people.
And
so it's quite shameful.
It's the same with all the so-called Iraq intelligence, right? About why they went to war with Iraq in 2003. Everyone's like, well, you know, I won't go into it in detail, but the FBI, CIA, you know, Powell, Bush, like they all were like, well, you know, this is what we were told. It's like, well, who's the one who said it? You know, like,
right.
It's just no one wants to take any responsibility. And that's the real problem that I have with that part. But I totally see your point. And I think it's for a number of things, for 9/11, it's for Iraq, it's for Katrina. It's for, you can, that article should have a list of all those things that they that no one took responsibility for, but yeah. It'd be just as long.
Yeah. But it's funny, we said, oh, we have a few minutes left, and now we've almost gone twice as long. But I think that's good. I think...
40 minutes, good.
Yeah, I think I've covered what I wanted to cover, which is funny since we had no list to begin with.
That's what it's about, right?
But, so next time we'll talk on episode 22, we'll sort of try to do our best of list. We'll think about what we want to talk about, whether or not you want to do your... Last year you did your top five Canadian albums.
Yes.
Whether or not you want to do that again, or... Well, we'll just figure something out, and we'll just play it by ear.
We'll figure it out, because... I don't even know if I've listened to as much Canadian music this year.
Right.
So, that year, I mean, it was the year of Tegan and Sarah, so...
Yes.
Until they come out with another album.
Yeah.
Maybe we can just do Best of Anything.
Best of Anything. Cool.
Yeah, 2008, rather. Okay, cool. Well, I guess that about ends it off for us here on the new blue microphone. The Snowball.
Until next time.
So long.
Farewell. Sorry, I was gonna start singing.